Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Project MedTech. I'm your host, Dwayne Mancini. As always, if you need anything from the podcast or would like to suggest a future guest, please email us at info@projectmedtech.com. If you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. And you can always visit our website, www.projectmedtech.com, or follow us on LinkedIn. This is another episode of MedTech Money powered by Project MedTech. This is a special series by Project MedTech where we have partnered with Mr. MedTech himself, Giovanni Loricella, in a series of podcast episodes focusing on money in the MedTech space. Giovanni's guest today is Olivier Litzka from Andera Partners. In this episode, Giovanni and Olivier discuss how Andera Partners was founded, when they invest in companies, how they build their portfolio of companies, how they have continued to invest in small companies with being such a large fund, what kind of companies they invest in, and more. So without further ado, Giovanni's discussion with Olivier Litzka.
Medical innovation starts with medical discussion. Talking about the future, what comes next with Project MedTech.
Olivier, thank you very much for your time and sharing your insights on what it's like to be a venture capitalist within Europe in the MedTech sector. And thank you for also sharing your wisdom on what is now MedTech Money, the podcast series, which is powered by Project MedTech, sponsored by Lifeblood Capital. And I wanted to say, the reason why we're here, I've talked to thousands of MedTech entrepreneurs and investors around the world, and I've discovered that there's really no silver bullet or specific formula about how to raise or invest capital in MedTech. So my goal here was I wanted to extract insights and anecdotal stories from investment bankers, entrepreneurs, investors like yourself, so that we can help those who could benefit from hearing this information, and also for generations of whether it's investors or entrepreneurs to come. So I imagine that the audience listening in today is a mixture of both experts in the field as well as novices. However, I wanted to extract particularly your stories and insights so that we could share with what I imagine the first-time founder or CEO who has no clue on what lies ahead of them in their journey of raising capital. So I thought the best place to start is learning from experienced professionals like yourself. And the reason why you and I are here today is I wanted to highlight what it's like to be a venture capital firm in Europe today, the status of European investments, international investments coming out of a VC within Europe, how the EU MDRs are affecting innovation in Europe, and what do we see in that grander picture? And then also simply to learn more about your background and your perspective on the medtech industry as a whole, once again, coming from that investor insight. So that's why we're here. But before we get into your background, I have a few open-ended questions that I wanted to ask you so we can start engaging the audience. And the first one is, do you believe that people and money are the lifeblood of a medtech startup? Why or why not? Or am I missing anything else important?
Hey, Giovanni, thank you for inviting me to this podcast, first of all. And happy to be one of the thousands and thousands of entrepreneurs you and VCs you were talking. I'm not sure there are thousands of VCs in MedTech, but there are certainly many, as I see from your annual update list. So we are one in Europe. And coming first to your introductory question, I mean, if you say that people are also the ones who have developed the technology, the underlying technology, which is underlying any medtech startup, then obviously the two ingredients are everything you need. But very often the technology comes from one part and one group of the people. And then there are other people who have not created the technologies, but they have the experience to develop them and to develop them a company out of this exciting technology will and should join such an endeavor in order to come to the second piece, in order to make sure that the company can attract enough of the capital which is needed, because it will be, in most cases, it will be a quite expensive endeavor and it will be a long endeavor. So if you boil it down, I agree, but there are a lot of facets to these two elements.
And you've built quite a long and in-depth career now being the managing partner of Endera Partners, and we'll get to that history. However, if you knew what you know now about being a medtech investor, would you do it all over again? Why or why not? Or what would you do differently if you could?
Yeah, let me be precise. We are a partnership of four partners in Endera Life Science. So I'm one of the four, which is an important criterion in a partnership. There is no boss. We have four partners and we need to work together. That's why I'm very interested to share this principle. So we are managing the funds together. Would I do it again? Absolutely, yes. I mean, come maybe to my background. I'm a scientist by background, and I got into business, and then I got into venture capital. And I think the interesting piece of all that is the bringing together, as you said, people, technologies, entrepreneurship, experience, money, bringing together and creating something which eventually will change something significantly for patients, because it's a new solution or it's a really improved solution for patients. So this amalgam, this mix of necessities to bring a startup to become successful and make a product out of a technology and then create a market, that's the fascinating thing, which is always fun when you think about the moment where it's maybe less fun because it's complicated. Then if you think about this principle, then it's just amazing to be in this spot.
And the last question, which I'm privy to a little bit behind the scenes, and I'm excited to ask it because it is a pretty cool story, at least for me. And I love the stories behind what's in a name. But what does the name of your company, your firm, mean, Endera Partners? How did that come to be?
Well, it's our entrepreneurial story which is behind this name, actually. Because our firm, now we are active in this space for 20 years. Life science investor, VC investor, but we started in a subsidiary of Edmond de Rothschild Bank, which had the appetite to create something like what we do. And at the beginning, they were extremely supportive. They continued to be supportive over many years, and we grew, and they seeded the fund. We raised the funds, not to believe that we were a family office or something like that. No, it was just the seed of a plant, and then many other institutional investors joined. And that's how we raised by Discovery 1, 2, 3, 4, and now 5, the last one we invested from. And now we are in the midst and coming to the end of raising by Discovery 6. So this is our own entrepreneurial story. But the management company was Edmond de Rothschild Investment Partners. That was the name of the subsidiary. And over the years, the partners in this firm got to see the bank and say, we want to buy step by step pieces of the management company, because that's how it should be. And so we bought step by step, and we achieved up to 49% of having ownership. And then we realized that the next step of our development should be total independence. And that is actually what we negotiated with Edmond Rothschild in 2018 successfully. We bought the remaining 51% as a team. But, then you are not Rothschild anymore. And we had to find a new name. And obviously, like many other people, we thought that finding a name that's dramatically easy. And so we went all off for a weekend and said, let's find a name. And we came back on a Monday, and then we had all our names, and we all were very proud of the names. And we found out in just half a day that they were all taken, or they were not useful names, and you couldn't deal with those. And then we went to professional guys, and they found Endera, and they it was an artificial name coming out of a phrase, because this is an entrepreneurial new step for us. And they said, so, and this is a new era, right? They said, this is a new era. And then they kept the and, and they kept the era, and then they made and era out of it. That's it, and era. And then obviously you have to use partners. So we had and era partners. And I mean, what the nice thing is about, and they now use it. I say yeah, they, because you know, marketing, etc. is really not my main business. But we have this firm, and they have pretty cool ideas, and now they market the and. And you remember what I said at the beginning, why it's fascinating to do what we do. It's about the end, you know, bringing people together and agreeing that alone they will not make it. That's basically, if you boil it even more down than your entry question, then it's appetite for cooperation and doing it together. And that's how we use it now.
I love that story. Thank you for sharing that. So, without further ado, you alluded to your background a little bit, but let's go into a little bit more depth. Who is Olivier Litzka? Where are you from? How'd you become managing partner of Endera Partners? And if you can squeeze in some details in between to let us know the man behind the voice that we're listening to now.
So maybe just winding back many, many years, I was just interested in everything which was scientific and nature and biology, etc. So I studied biology, then my molecular biology. I became a scientist. I did a PhD. The majority of that in Munich University, a part of it in Oxford University, and then after research, I just saw that there, you know, I'm missing. I didn't want to stay being a researcher on the bench. So the question is what you do next. And then I went to management consulting as an exotic guy, sort of contribute to teams which were thinking about how to improve businesses, and into Mercer management for a couple of years to see a little bit on a very high level, very interesting level, of what business is all alike. And did this until the year 2000. And I saw in Munich that there was a hell of a lot of things going on in Martinsried and the biotech hub, biotech cluster. And then one came to the other. I knew people in VC business, and I started to understand what this is about. And joined TI, UK house, was there investing in Germany, then in Europe for 4 years. Then they asked me, I have a French-German background. I have my family is half French, half German. So they then asked me to come to France and head the activities for 3i in Paris, which I did, moved with the family, and did this for another 2 years. But I realized also after one and a half years that 3i might not, 3i is a big private equity house and venture capitalist in a big listed private equity house. It's not easy. It's not an easy life. And after about a decade in venture capitalist, they actually decided in 2007 or so, 2 years after I left, to stop this. So I saw this and then I wanted to stay in France, looked around, looked for an ambitious team which might want to, you know, accept me as a further partner. And that was actually, I joined Raphael Wisniewski and Gilles Nobeko from Edrip. They had just raised fund number 2. They were ambitious. They wanted to grow. They had great ideas, and they accepted me to join them as a third partner. And that's it. And since then, I'm with them. And then we have now as a fourth partner, Sofia Ioannidou, who started with us and became partner 2 years ago. So we had a partnership of 4. And we will further expand and also hire, actually, because with the new fund, you know, it's growing. It's a growing entity.
So now that we brought you to this point of being managing partner, one of many partners, 4 partners at Endera Partners, tell us about Endera Partners. Tell us about what you guys focus in at, size of funds, type of typical startups that you invest in, technologies that you assess. Give us a picture of who Endera Partners is.
So you are a medtech guy, as a deep medtech guy, Giovanni, but just to be precise, we do 2/3 of our investments in biotech. and one third in MedTech, which is for us pretty cool because we believe that, you know, when you go into the biochemistry of a disease, then you need to go with a drug or with an antibody or whatever in order to change the course of a disease. But if the infrastructure, if you want, the real estate of a body is sort of, you know, not in good shape, then this not in good shape has probably deteriorated over many years. And then it's mechanically, often it's mechanically, I'm simplifying, right? But mechanically, there is something which is not, you know, working anymore. And very often, you're just too late with a drug. It's very, very difficult to change the course of the disease with a drug. So if a heart valve is calcified, you will not get the calcification away, you know, other than, you know, comparing with the statement of a famous president, you need to inject some acid maybe to inject acid to get the calcification away. No, that's not working anymore, you know. So there needs to be some mechanical changes. And this is very often what MedTech brings. The worn down knee, the calcification in a valve, nerves, which you know, which needs stimulation in order to work better again. So this is where MedTech comes, and this is why MedTech can bring fantastic solutions. So 2/3 biotech, 1/3 MedTech, which is in a big fund, still a big amount of money to invest in. And we have not been coming in and out into MedTech. We have been constantly there for 20 years, more than 20 years. We do invest in European companies, 2/3 again of it, and 1/3 in the US. We believe in companies which have a transatlantic reach. We think for European companies, it's great to partner with US VCs and US entrepreneurs, etc. And we go in all sorts of indication, also in MedTech, neurostim, cardiovascular, orthopedics, robotics, pumps for diabetes. So we have accumulated a lot of experience. There are still areas which we don't know, but there are areas where we know a lot, just an accumulation over the many years. And then in terms of stages, that's a bit you know, difficult for some entrepreneurs to understand, but we do very early company formation things. We go in with the founder and really, you know, spin out or early creation of a company. That doesn't mean that the asset is super early as well. It can be a well advanced one coming out of a university, which has done a lot with that, or an institute. So this is company formation. About a third of what we do is company formation, really being there at the very beginning. And then in about a third, we just give the second acceleration when there is a Series A or Series B to be done, and building syndicates and hiring teams, etc. And then in some instances, we come quite late, you know, CE mark is there, switching to PMA, or early commercialization, or a company which is planning to go public. We will help the company to go public and then follow for a while once the company is public. So quite early, advanced, and late, we do everything of that. This is part of our DNA and our idea on how to build a portfolio, because every entrepreneur should know that the money we give to companies is not our money. It's not falling from the sky. We need to raise it every 4 years. We need to go out and raise a new fund. So we have to have a strategy. And our strategy is that we want to balance the risk which we expose our investors. We want to balance this risk with early, advanced, and later stage companies.
So I have a bunch of questions that came out of that. So thank you for sharing that. I'll start methodically so we can dig a little bit deeper into what you shared. So it's quite often that we hear that MedTech is a part of a fund. typically life sciences and med tech, and with life sciences, biopharma being the larger portion, very similar to what you just mentioned. Why is that? I mean, there's very few funds that are solely directed to med tech. And there's a lot more that are solely directed at biopharma, but there are some that do both. Why is that? What's the economics behind hedging life sciences and biopharma and med tech together? What's that purpose?
So it's really what I said. You know, it's really what I said. The industry, by the way, the pharma industry is 2 times bigger than the med tech industry. But that just leaves a huge med tech industry, which is there because it has a purpose, and it has products which help solve medical issues, you know. So it's there, and it has a very important contribution to healthcare, and therefore we like to sort of mimic in our fund this ratio between drugs and devices. And it's interesting, in some indications, you know, you have drugs and you have devices, you know. In diabetes, you have obviously insulin, but you need to have a bloody pump to get it there, or you have an injector to inject the insulin. So that's the most obvious example of a combination of drug and device. But in many areas, when drugs don't work anymore, the device takes over and has a very important role to play. So for us, it's a logic coming from medicine, first of all. Not so much financial hedging or whatsoever. It's logic for treating patients. So that's the first thing. And then, why are there biopharma concentrated funds and not so many medtech concentrated funds? Difficult question. I think some funds don't like medtech so much. First thing, and second, biotech is quite complicated, right? And it's already very diverse. Many indications, I mean, look into the biochemistry of the body. It's just amazingly complicated. And they want to stick to that. And they don't want to move into medtech, which is okay as a strategy, because the field is huge in itself. For us, it had worked to do both. And some others do as well. But some others have gone into medtech when it was fashionable. Then they went out of medtech, and then they came in again. You know, now you see more medtech, of course. You know, the market, the public market has been very open for medtech companies, and that has attracted new, revitalized interest into medtech.
And so, it sounds more of like a logical, like you mentioned, but also philosophical way of approaching, of saying we're tackling both life science and med tech for the sake of healthcare. But there also is economics behind it, right? Sometimes funds think that biotech is just more economically valuable, right? Bigger exits, getting in earlier exits, things like that. It's just sometimes make more money.
Yeah, well, you see, our observation is that it comes in waves. Obviously, now the last 5, 6, 7 years have been an enormous wave for biotech. But, you know, if we look in our exits, there are years where we had 3 exits in a row in medtech, and then we had a couple of exits in biotech. And, you know, we can plan to build great companies around great technologies. But what will happen in 3, 4, 5 years in terms of market? Will there be an IPO market? How many acquirers will be there? You know, have they consolidated? Of course, in medtech, for example, you have less acquirers, right? That's the major difference when you think about, you know, where will these companies go? You have not this plethora of pharma or big biotech companies which can acquire your startup. So So that's for me probably one of the main differences which you have to deal with and which you have to keep in mind. But the good news is that, as I mentioned before, the public markets have been extremely receptive for MedTech in the last 4 years. You know this, Giovanni, right? It's amazing what happened since 2000. What is it? 18, 6, 17. Yeah, it started. One of our companies, Axonics, was one of the first ones which went there, and it has been tremendously successful. And we were amazed to see that we have now also in MedTech the alternative to either think about a trade sale or to give an independent continuation for the company via public markets. So I think that's everything I can add to that to this question.
And so also you mentioned you have a focus in cardiovascular, neuromodulation, surgical robotics. We'll call that the hard or complex med tech. We see a lot of these other funds that are sticking to the new stuff, AI, digital health, class 2, 510K, shorter lifetimes. I mean, you're getting into the hard stuff. You're getting into that true medical device hard stuff. What's the focus there versus getting on some of these bandwagons of doing the AI and the digital health and the softer stuff?
So the AI digital health is another area like diagnostics, which we don't do. It's probably a matter of focus and it's a matter of competence. We have not acquired so far competent people in our team for this area. We always wonder, once a year, should we do this, or you know, should we move into that, and when? But at the end, we are very busy with biotech and medtech, and probably it's very much tech oriented, as it says, right? Digital is very tech oriented, software and technology outside of medical. And I'm not 100% sure whether in Europe we are at the best spot for this. If you think about where Silicon Valley is on tech, which you combine then with, you know, medical applications, there might be an advantage there to start up businesses. Yes, we go into really game-changing medical technologies. We like that. That's the same in biotech as well. That doesn't mean that we always have to come with companies which have the very first new device into an indication and take the whole risk, you know. It can also be a company which has observed that there is a very cool technology with a market leader, but there are still important limitations and they have a significant improvement that's still very innovative. They will still have to go take the regulatory hurdle, the big regulatory hurdle, right? But they are not the ones which have to tackle all the risks from the very first one. So that's not a necessity that it's always completely new. Sometimes we go into an existing market and come with a significant improvement, and sometimes we take the heavy lifting with something completely new. Yeah. So if you think about Half Valve, for example, we came with a company, Jena Valve, which came with really incredible improvements of the existing. And then take another example, robotics. We have a company in Italy called MMI Microsurgical. It's the first ever microsurgical robotic, where the questions are often, you know, how big is the market? How many, you know, very fundamental questions are asked to this company, which is typical for companies which do something completely new. So the uncertainty of the market, of the reimbursement, etc., everything is there, but it's so new and it's just so powerful that people, surgeons who use it, try it out, they see immediately why it's there and why it will completely change the practice.
And then you mentioned, which I found also very unique, the fact that you invest in early, mid-stage, or that secondary injection, like you mentioned, and then later stage companies. Oftentimes, when you hear of startups, they proudly classify themselves as early stage investors or late stage investors, or we only do seed or maybe series A, or we only do when you have regulatory clearance or commercial, or I should say approval, and then you're going commercial. And it typically goes into ticket size too, and we can get into that later, but how does that structure work? Because that's unique. We don't hear that quite often, that a company like yourself can give the smaller tickets on the early stuff, give the middle size tickets and the late stage stuff.
That's really what I said at the beginning. It's really about balancing the risk. But on the other hand, you know, what we don't want to do is to be a VC like, you know, like the football soccer player, which stands in front of the goal and just waiting that he gets the ball and then kicks it in, you know? That's the focused 100% late stage investor. You know, the heavy lifting has been done. You come with the big tickets, and that's very often necessary. Yeah. And I simplify, of course. I simplify. But you cannot do this all the time. You shouldn't do this all the time. Everything. So you need to create, someone needs to create these new companies and help to create these new companies. And we like to do it very much. But you cannot do this all the time. That's our experience. You cannot focus, or at least this is not what we have explained to our investors. Yeah. If you do this all the time, it might take very long, and sometimes, you know, it will not work and you have to stop. That's okay from time to time, but not too often. And therefore, our personal Andera magic sauce is this mix of early, mid, and late. When we go early, people know that we can follow them long time because we have the big funds which are necessary, and we have the capacity to syndicate and bring in colleagues. There are very capable colleagues out there. We love to work with many. So when we start with them together, these entrepreneurs, founders, then they can be assured that, you know, if things progress well and there is openness to bring in experienced people and the technology delivers step by step, then there will be funds with Andera Partners and there will be a syndication powerhouse here. And for more advanced companies, they come and see us and they say, you know, we have a very significant next step to take. And your experience in this sector would be helpful. So, and we need a big amount of money. And would you join a syndicate as a lead investor? So then this is also appropriate for us. And for our investors, again, it is reassuring that we have this mix. Because the companies which are more advanced, they have obviously earlier exit opportunities, which can then generate liquidity for our investors again. I stress a little bit this piece of us being into a sandwich position, right? People should know this, you know, we have our investors, we need to deliver to them. And then on the other side, there are these companies which we want to work together and be successful together. So we need to deal with both sides. And if this system works and we are successful with our companies, then our investors are happy and they will come into the next fund. In order to assure this, we have created this concept of a balanced portfolio. And therefore, sometimes we can do early and sometimes we go into later situation. But if we go early, we can have the patience to take the time it needs.
And this is what's interesting me. And so I'm asking the second question for myself, because it seems logical. If you can get early, mid, and late, that would be great. But to your point about some of the, like the football soccer analogy that you made about someone standing close to the goal, right, being late stage investors, I'm learning as well. So that's why I'm asking the question. When I've talked to some of the bigger funds, whether it's in Europe or even in the United States, and they have the 350, the 400, the $500 million funds, and they say, well, now we're a bigger fund. In order for us to deploy and have it make sense and be worth our time, we are doing minimum check sizes, 15 million. That's the lowest we can go. Yes, we can take on more to continue adding on, but us as being a $350 or a $500 million fund, us putting in $3 million or $5 million, it doesn't make sense. So once again, I'm learning. That's why I'm asking the second question. It just sounds very unique for Endera, which I like the philosophy of early, mid, and late, and it makes sense. But sometimes when these bigger funds are up against a 10-year horizon or a 10-year timeline, that's what I'm asking. How is that? How does Endera be able to pull that off? Like, how can you stand near the goal and kick in the late stage stuff with the higher tickets, but still have the long-term patience for the smaller ticket sizes, getting in some of those company creation?
Well, if you have a 10-year fund, look, then if you go in too late and in 2 years the company has an exit, you know, you don't have to do this each time. But in my logic, you don't have to do this each time in 3-4 years. I mean, of course, it's always great to have it fast and, you know, the best is to have an exit before you get in, right? Of course, the shorter, the better, in theory. But in practical sense, you know, I think you also earn a certain reputation if you really take the joint effort, sometimes pain, to move something through, you know, technical difficulties, then regulatory difficulty, and then you're really a partner who will help. At least we try. Yeah? We've done a lot of mistakes, therefore we have a lot of experience. We will do new mistakes, of course, but hopefully not the same again. And over the many years, I mean, you can apply this experience to helping start exciting technologies and turn them into companies while still coming in late sometimes and helping for commercialization and having an exit in 2 years or 4 years. I find it appealing for us, for our investors, and hopefully also for the companies who come and see us with their companies. So I know these mega funds, they have difficulties to start with a 2 million ticket. So we are in the 450, 400, 500, maybe soon a bit more dollar category. A third of this, remember, is MedTech. So we can have, let's say, 7, 8, 9 companies in MedTech in such a fund. There can be 2 or 3 or 4 of them which are early, and then the rest is more advanced and some of them are late. And we spend obviously more time in the earlier ones and hopefully a little bit less time in the more advanced ones because the setup is obviously much more professional. And this balance is also, to be honest, it's also fun for us, right? The diversity of that is fun.
I like that.
And you learn from the more advanced what they have done in their past, and you can reapply it in the earlier one. So it's our way of doing. It's not the right way for everyone. For us, it's fine.
I want to take a look at the global picture now, or at least the international picture. You not only invest in Europe, but you also look at US funds. Like you mentioned, a third of your fund is looking at the US. What do you think, and I want to talk very high generalizations at this point, but what do you think are the major differences in the ecosystem of European VCs versus US VCs? Are there cultural differences? Are there economic differences? Just, I want to hear for the audience to hear, and your perspective, are there differences between European VCs and US VCs?
I mean, so let me explain what we do in the US and how we do it compared to Europe, right? And then maybe I come to if there are differences. But what we can obviously, being based in Europe, especially in the earlier stages, as a general rule, and then there will be exemptions, but as a general rule, it's for us easier to be in the earlier phases of development of a company in Europe because it's close. You can go and see and, you know, fly there and non-COVID period I'm talking. Go there and, you know, and work hard with the company to move it to the next stage. In the US, there is a special angle for us. We know a founder, we know a co-investor very well. We know a manager very well. That's the reason why we joined a medtech company in the US. So seen from the US side, there may be less super early stage for US companies because just too far away, you know, it's difficult to be close. So that's how we see it and how we do it. Now, I give you an example. Axonix, our neuromodulation company in overactive bladder, around Ray Cohen. We were the startup founding investor in a Californian company. That's the exemption. Why? Because we knew Ray from a former company, which we did with him. My colleague Rafael and Ray worked together on Vesix, which was a successful exit to Boston Scientific. And then, he was just the first one he called to start Axonix. That's 7-8 years ago. And look where it is now. So now, once you are a European successful, and there are obviously fantastic technologies in Europe, as you know. Many valve technologies came from Europe. Many orthopedics companies were in 10 years ago came from Europe. There's a lot of neurostim going on. So there's fantastic stuff here. There's really good founders, returning entrepreneurs, and so on and so on. But then, you know, there is obviously now with the opening of capital markets for MedTech, we apply the same model which we apply to our biopharma companies, that we want to have mixed syndicates, because this adds a different experience level. Even it becomes even more professional, and then it's where we successfully now make US investors join our European companies. And when you can then come to the question, what is different? I mean, US funds have a different access to capital markets, right? So easy. The connection to crossover funds, we have built this over many years, but having a US VC, joining your MedTech company in Europe is already a step to be more visible. And then you add US management to the company, you have mixed teams. I mean, that increases the visibility of the company, and then it gives a much easier access to crossover investors and then potentially to Nasdaq. So, but your original question was, do US or European VCs do the business tremendously different? Probably not. Yeah. If you find good partners on the other side of the Atlantic, it's great. And, you know, we have super good understanding what needs to be done next to help the company. And that's important, right? You co-invest with people at the end.
One of my last questions, and thank you again for your time on this. With the new implementation of the European medical device regulations that finally came into effect in May, it's been a topic of large conversation for the past few years for sure. There's been a total shift in the regulatory focus where companies around the world would stop in your backyard in Europe first for CE mark, and now we see a lot of them looking to the FDA first. Has the European medical device regulations, the EU MDRs, have they affected deal flow in any capacity for you?
So answer for deal flow, not at all. But obviously this change, you know, it's not the change in itself, but it's the uncertainty of many, many years what will be the new regulation and who will deal with our companies on the regulatory side. That is really has been tough. That has really been tough. I mean, you know where it came from, that everything was put upside down. There was this PIP scandal with the breast implants, which was a disaster, terrible. But this was a crime, right? It's a crime. And And it ended up into trying to avoid crime through regulation, right? Now, was the CE mark, was there a necessity to do some improvements? Probably yes, yeah, and to raise the bar, maybe yes. But was it necessary to have this uncertainty over so many years to avoid a crime? I'm not sure, because a crime can even happen under NDD, you know, or MDR. No difference. You if you cheat like that, then you know you, that's very difficult to check. But now it starts to sort out. And then in the meantime, obviously the FDA was very clever. Early feasibility study, EFS, and all sorts of so-called facilitation. You know what? Now many companies realize that there is also uncertainty with the FDA. We have in several companies, we have surprises. Suddenly, something which was thought to be okay is not okay. And I mean, regulatory paths remain a little bit uncertain. That's why some of these super late stage investors, they say, I don't want to take regulatory risk at all. I want an approved drug, and then I help you to become a multi-billion dollar company. And then they come the next one and say, oh, I don't like the reimbursement risk. Then I ask, which type of risk do you want to take, by the way? So it has had a tremendous impact. Nobody can say the opposite, because this was the laboratory for startups, right, in Europe, first with CE mark. But I see now still many companies now doing the CE mark under the new regulation, or planning the CE mark under the new regulation, because now they have sort of a clue how it will go. And some of the notified bodies are now understanding what needs to be done. And it becomes more predictable, a little bit more predictable than it was in the past years. So the pendulum went to the FDA. Now some companies say, oh gosh, it's also not so easy. So the jury's out, I think. And the best for companies is to be prepared to know both sides very well and think through it carefully what the best regulatory path is. I would not sort of see a blueprint template for every company to do it this way and not another way. It needs imagination and experience to find the right regulatory path, my view.
My last question, very short and concise, just for those listeners out there to understand the geographical understanding of where the money is flowing. Paris, where Endera Partners is located, we have Endera Partners, Sofinnova, Truffle Capital, Anexigo, Carista. There's a lot of VC money focused in the healthcare sector, life sciences, med tech, digital health, for example. Yes, there's a lot of VCs throughout the whole entirety of Europe, but there's a lot going on in Paris. Is there a reason why?
The funds you name, there are. I think there are not so many who do this international investing. There are many earlier which do invest in medtech, but they wouldn't scale the companies like us and Sofinnova, I would say, and invest all over Europe and in the US and make the connections, etc. But it's a good ground, yes, for financing. As you know, I'm now since 8 months, I'm based in Munich, so we have expanded sort of the location also into the German-speaking area. Here there are a couple of funds also doing medtech. And, you know, for us, it doesn't really make a big difference where we are located or so, but the opportunities we invest in can be in Belgium or in Switzerland or in Italy for MMI, for example, or of course, Germany and the Netherlands. So, we are a European investor with a certain focus on France and a strong focus also on the German-speaking area, but it doesn't preclude us from doing good investments all over Europe and in the US.
Olivier Litzka, managing partner of Endera Partners, thank you very much for your time, also for your insights on exploring what it is to be a European venture capitalist who also looks at US deals. And also thank you for sharing your career, your history, and a lot more of what you do at Endera. So for all those listening, hope you enjoyed. Thank you very much for your time. This is MedTech Money, where we demystify raising capital. Thank you, Olivier.
Thank you, Giovanni, for inviting me. It was a pleasure and fun to discuss. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. If you need anything from the podcast, you can always contact us at info@projectmedtech.com. Thanks for listening and have a great day.